It's a lot of women that's coming out, you know, and expressing themselves about what happened to them.
I really hope the Me Too movement is propelling us in that direction where assaulting people has consequences.
I think it's important that we listen to all of the women that are coming out and telling their stories and work on how we can engage them in a healing process.
The Me Too movement has led many people to share their experiences with sexual harassment and sexual assault. It has sparked conversation, controversy, and maybe change. I'm Charity Nebbe. Look for Unsettled, Mapping Me Too, a new podcast from Iowa Public Radio, in the iTunes store and on Google Play, or find it at iowapublicradio.org.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We think of Winston Churchill as a hero who saved the world from Nazism and warned of Soviet communism. But what does Churchill have to teach us about the challenges that leaders face today? My guest today is New York Times bestselling author Andrew Roberts. Roberts has authored a new biography on Winston Churchill. It's being called the definitive biography of this iconic British leader. His previous books include The Storms of War, A New History of the Second World War, Masters and Commanders, How Four Titans Won the War in the West, 1941 to 1945, and Napoleon, A Life. That one was the winner of the Los Angeles Times Book Prize for Biography. His new book is titled Churchill, Walking with Destiny. It's based on more than 30 years of researching and writing about Churchill, and Roberts interviews with over 100 people who knew and worked with Churchill. A Kirkus-starred review calls the biography of over 1,000 pages the most comprehensive single-volume biography of Churchill that we have in print. Andrew Roberts, what a pleasure to have you on the program. Welcome.
Thank you so much, Ben. It's an honor to be on the show.
This book is based on extensive new material. Tell us, what were you able to turn to as a biographer that previous Churchill biographers could not?
Yes, I've been tremendously fortunate that in the last 10 years there has been a cornucopia of new sources about Winston Churchill. I think the primary one is that Her Majesty the Queen allowed me to be the first Churchill biographer to use her father's diaries. And King George VI met Winston Churchill every single Tuesday of the Second World War, and they talked about the most important and secret things. They served themselves from the sideboard so that servants needn't be present. And they talked about the Enigma secrets, the nuclear secrets. Churchill told the king about the countries that were going to be attacked and when and where. And also about various ministers and generals who were going to be hired and fired. So you have, really, from the horse's mouth, the king then wrote down everything that Churchill said, a brand new and quite extraordinary new source there. You also have 41 sets of papers that have been deposited at the Churchill Archives in Cambridge over the last 10 years, including Churchill's daughter's diary from 1940. And you also have, in the last 10 years, the Soviet ambassador, Ivan Maisky's diaries, and who spoke to Churchill a lot, especially during the Nazi-Soviet pact. And the love letters of Pamela Harriman, which are pretty exciting and somewhat racy. And you have the War Cabinet verbatim accounts, which have also come out over the last 10 years. So there is something on pretty much every page of this biography that won't have appeared in any Churchill biography before.
Mm-hmm. I wonder if any of this new material shed more light on Winston Churchill's relationship, his thoughts about the U.S. during the Second World War, and his thoughts. Yes?
Yes. Oh, no, they did. They definitely did. Yes, in fact, if anything, it's probably the thing that they shed most light on, not least because it was clear that Churchill couldn't in public criticize the United States, let alone the Roosevelt administration, for not getting more involved in the Second World War earlier. But it's very clear from his conversations with King George VI that he was deeply frustrated and irritated, really, because he saw the Second World War as being a war for civilization and democracy against Hitler and the Nazis. And he couldn't understand why the Americans weren't keener to get involved. The sort of level of isolationism in pre-war America was very high, and he found it extremely frustrating. But of course, this wasn't something he could say in public, so he really sort of let go when it came to doing it in private. And these are the papers that I've I've been very lucky to be able to use.
In these lunches, I understand from reading your book, the King George VI's wartime diaries, Winston Churchill told the king many jokes. I wonder if you can share a favorite that he shared with the king.
Yes, there's a marvelous moment during the Hess flight when Rudolf Hess, the deputy Führer of Germany, flew to Scotland, in fact, and wound up in the Tower of London. And he came in May 1941 bearing a peace offer. And he, of course, was the titular second-in-command of the whole of Germany after Adolf Hitler. And Winston Churchill joked to the king, I certainly shouldn't like Anthony Eden or Max Beaverbrook to do that to me. But there are lots of jokes and lots of aperçus and lots of... I mean, the great thing about Winston Churchill is that because he had this great sense of destiny, he didn't... and he therefore, you know, assumed that that he was going to save London and save the country. He was able to joke, even in the direst of situations. And some of the funniest jokes he comes up with actually are in the most perilous moments for my country.
Andrew Roberts, you write extensively about the 65 years of Winston Churchill's life before he became Prime Minister and how that prepared him for his leadership during the Second World War, which was so crucial. Describe some of the lessons he learned in those 65 years, perhaps younger Winston Churchill. He was in the First World War. We've been commemorating the 100th anniversary of the end of the First World War. Describe the kind of failures and errors he made and he learned from. What were his biggest mistakes?
Oh, well, he made many, many errors in his life. He made blunder after blunder, really. But the great thing was, as I think you've mentioned, yes, he learned from them. And the classic example, of course, being the Dardanelles catastrophe of 1915. When he was First Lord of the Admiralty, which meant that he was in charge of the British Royal Navy, he came up with, on the face of it, a totally brilliant plan, which was to get the Royal Navy through the straits of the Dardanelles and moor it off Istanbul in Turkey and effectively knock the Ottoman Empire out of the Central Powers and split them off from Germany and Austria. It would have been a brilliant strategic move, but unfortunately, in the actual implementation of it, on the 18th of March 1915, six of the Allied ships were sunk, and it turned out to be a disaster. And instead of pushing, of giving it up completely, he then went on to attack the landmass next to it, the Gallipoli Peninsula, which led to the killing and wounding of 160,000 Allied troops. And this was, of course, held against him for the rest of his life and the rest of his political career. But in the Second World War, he learned from it, and what he did was never once to overrule the Chiefs of Staff, as he had done in the Dardanelles campaign. And instead, when the Chiefs of Staff all agreed on something in the Second World War, even though he had the power to, because he was Minister of Defense as well as Prime Minister, he never once overruled them. So it's a classic example amongst many, many examples of Churchill actually learning from his mistakes.
Mm-hmm. That's what's remarkable about this book is that you put his mistakes there front and center, and it all also makes it so interesting when you learn about these mistakes that the context at which he became leader of the British government as prime minister. Give us a sense, because we only see him in historical context, as this icon that saved the world, if you will. Give us a sense of the opposition he faced within the British government when he took the reins.
Well, it was quite extraordinary that he ever did become prime minister, because, first of all, he'd left the Conservative Party in 1904 and hadn't come back to it until 1924. And by 1940, an awful lot of people just simply didn't trust him. They didn't trust his judgment, not least over the Gallipoli affair of 25 years earlier. Most of the backbenchers of the Conservative Party didn't trust him and didn't want him to be leader. But he nonetheless did become leader. The king didn't want him to be prime minister, but nonetheless he became it. He was opposed by the great forces of the land, The overwhelming majority of the cabinet didn't want him. The Times newspaper didn't want him. The Church of England didn't want him. The City of London didn't want him. You know, these are important aspects, especially in those days of the British establishment. Thought that he was an adventurer and a gambler, and he lacked judgment. But nonetheless, because he had been he'd held many of the offices of state. He'd been Chancellor of the Exchequer and Home Secretary and First Lord of the Admiralty in two World Wars. And he also seemed to be the only man who had, first of all, warned against Hitler, of course, and had got that right. And secondly, who wanted to take the battle to the enemy. He got the job in the most extraordinary of circumstances.
If you've just joined us, my guest is New York Times bestselling author Andrew Roberts. He has a new biography, the definitive biography of Winston Churchill, out. It's called Churchill, Walking with Destiny, based on more than 30 years of researching and writing about Churchill and interviews with over 100 people who knew and worked with Churchill. The title, Walking with Destiny, that comes, you drew that from his own memoir, The Gathering Storm. He always felt that, I think you quote in the book, he believed from a young age he was destined to save Britain.
That's right. At the end of The Gathering Storm, the first volume of his six volumes of war memoirs, he wrote, "I felt as if I were walking with destiny and that all my past life has been but a preparation for this hour and for this trial." And one of the things that made him believe that he was being specially chosen he talked about invisible wings that flapped over him to protect him, was that he had so many brushes with death as a young man and indeed later on in his life. He believed that he was being specially marked out to save London and the country. He was stabbed in the stomach at the age of 10 by a penknife. He nearly died of pneumonia at the age of 11. He nearly drowned in Lake Geneva. He nearly died in two plane crashes, three car crashes, a house fire. He took part in a cavalry charge where 25% of his unit were killed or wounded, and a train ambush where 34% were. He escaped from prison and crossed 300 miles of enemy territory. This is long before he even started to risk his life in the First World War or the Second World War. And so he wound up thinking that the Almighty was keeping a special eye on him. In fact, theologically, the thing that the Almighty seemed primarily to be sent to do was to keep an eye on Winston Churchill.
And yes, you must have ruminated an alternate scenario where Winston Churchill was not on this earth, was not the prime minister at that point in history. The world would have seen a much different history.
It would have been a disaster for Britain, and I also think for the wider world as well, because if the Royal Navy, which was the largest navy in the world at that time, had fallen into the hands of the Germans, which of course also had an enormous navy, and therefore was allied with the Vichy French and the Italian navies, and I'm afraid there's nothing that the relatively much smaller American navy could have done to have prevented a devastating attack on your eastern seaboard, or just a threat to your eastern seaboard, if the Roosevelt administration hadn't made some kind of an arrangement of accommodation with Adolf Hitler. Under those circumstances, then I'm afraid you'd have seen the shelling of the great eastern seaboard cities such as Boston and New York and Miami and Charleston and Baltimore.
You also write about the emotional side of Churchill, which is surprising, will be surprising to those who don't dig deeply into this. You write that Churchill never minded crying in public.
Yes, he burst into tears over 50 times during the Second World War. He was not the buttoned-up Victorian aristocrat at all of his age and class and background. He was, in fact, a sort of throwback to an earlier era. He was a Regency romantic figure. Who wore his heart on his sleeve. And I think it would be very off-putting today if Theresa May was to burst into tears in the House of Commons. I think it would be very worrying for us. But with Winston Churchill, everybody just appreciated that he was a hugely passionate and emotional man. This is what comes out mostly, really, from my from my book, was the way in which he was driven by his passions much more than most of his contemporaries.
Soon after the war, Churchill, who had been defeated for re-election as prime minister in 1945, was invited to Missouri, to Westminster College in Fulton, Missouri. He gave a speech in March of 1946. President Truman joined Churchill on the platform. You have a picture in this book of Churchill delivering this speech and a photo of the page from his actual speech notes in the book where he first warned of Soviet-dominated Eastern Europe, where he warned that an Iron Curtain had fallen across Europe.
From Stettin in the Baltic to Trieste in the Adriatic, an Iron Curtain has descended across the continent. Behind that line lie all the capitals of the ancient states of Central and Eastern Europe.
Andrew Roberts, why Fulton, Missouri?
He was asked to go there because President Truman wanted him to go to the Midwest. And, of course, Churchill had actually visited a lot of the Midwest before in various speaking tours that he'd done in the late 1920s and early 1930s. And so it was a favor, really, to Harry Truman.
Mm-hmm. And that comment about the Iron Curtain, was he actually the first to warn of the Soviet Eastern domination, Eastern European domination?
Just like before the Second World War, he had warned against Hitler and the Nazis. So he was also the first major person in the after the Second World War to warn against Stalin and the Soviet threat. And in both cases, nobody wanted to listen to him. And he was attacked very violently for his Iron Curtain speech, the one you've just heard just then, was profoundly unpopular because people still wanted to see the Russians as having been the people who had, you know, bled so profusely in defeating the Nazis only the previous year. But Churchill had this tremendous foresight and was able to see that the Iron Curtain had indeed fallen. And yet he was attacked in the press, he was attacked in Congress, he was attacked in the House of Commons. 100 MPs wrote a motion, signed a motion denouncing him. It was a very unpopular speech, and it was only really time that over the next 2 and 3 years became clear that he had been right and they had been wrong again.
Mm. Mm. Andrew Roberts, my guest, the last few minutes of our conversation, I want to ask, of course, what lessons you think might Churchill have to teach about the challenges faced by leaders today?
Well, I think this question of foresight, of course, is a tremendously important one. Leaders must try to get beyond the present day and see what they think their countries are going to be having to face in the long-term future, which was something that Churchill was very good at. I think physical and moral courage, the two don't always go together, but they certainly did with Winston Churchill. To be able to say something unpopular because you believe it, I think is an essential prerequisite, really, for this. And also eloquence. Churchill, of course, worked incredibly hard on his speeches. He practiced them endlessly, and he thought about them. He always wrote his own speeches. He never gave anybody else's speech. It was always came from him. And of course, that was a good thing because people really understood that it came from him and from his heart and brain. And I think, therefore, that my book is really packed with the leadership lessons that Winston Churchill has to give not only the present time but also the future.
Mm-hmm. You write in your book, Churchill was supremely egotistical, instinctively combative, and prone to deliberate exaggeration, and he consistently underestimated the negative impression that these traits made on people. And I quote that because, and I know they have many more dissimilarities than similarities, and you may strenuously disagree, but in some ways you could also see that as a description of Donald Trump, couldn't you?
I think all three of those things, yes, could be, or four of them could be seen in his case. Absolutely. It's I think you have to have a pretty strong ego to want to be Prime Minister of Great Britain or President of America anyway, don't you? Truly shy and retiring people don't enter top-level politics, I don't think. And Winston Churchill very much was a man driven by his ambition and his ego, but also this sense of destiny that he retained from being a 16-year-old schoolboy, in which he believed that he was going to save London and the country, and that was something that was nurtured within him because of a large number of close brushes with death. He served in four wars on four different continents. He, in the First World War, which of course we are just commemorating the centenary of at the moment, he went into no man's land some 30 times, so close to the German lines that he could actually hear the Germans speaking. And this this tremendous sense of moral and physical courage are also things, I think, that every leader can learn from.
Mm-hmm. What would you say to Churchill, Winston Churchill, or ask him about if you had a few hours to meet with him today?
Oh, I'd give my little finger right now to meet with Winston Churchill today. It would be a small price to pay. I would absolutely love to be able to. I think I would ask him about this idea of destiny. He was a great great admirer of Napoleon. Always had a bust of Napoleon on his desk and used to quote from Napoleon. And Napoleon, of course, also was somebody who had this very strong sense of their own personal destiny. And I'd like to talk to him about where he got it from, the way in which it sustained him during the long, drawling tides of drift and surrender, as he used to call it, of the 1930s, where no one was listening to him and everybody seemed to be willing to put up with the rise of Hitler and the Nazis, and that terrible sense of frustration that he had, and yet the way in which he was able to see it through and come to the fruition of his premiership in May 1940. And I think this driving sense of destiny is something that I'd like to unpack and investigate a bit with him.
Okay, thank you very much. Andrew Roberts, his new biography of Winston Churchill is titled Churchill, Walking with Destiny. Andrew Roberts, what a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ben. I've really enjoyed it.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.